Moncrief on News Talk. From the heinous to the ridiculous. This is Moncrief's Murder Club.
Yes, it's time for the Moncrief Murder Club with podcaster Cassie Delaney. And I very much appreciate your stories this week because you've had me in mind. They're all related to reality TV.
Yeah, I knew. I saw you were here this week, Fionnuala. I said, you're a gal who loves a bit of reality TV. I'm a gal who loves a bit of murder. Let's combine the two. And I have stories for you today of people who've done the murders, but prior to that, appeared on reality TV.
Okay. Do you think there's a correlation between the types of people who commit murder and want to be on reality TV, exposed to the nation, exposed to the masses?
Want to be famous.
Yeah.
Definitely. Yeah, there's got to be. Not all reality TV stars want to be murderers, but I think there is definitely something in that desire to be notorious and that desire to be known. There's a certain personality trait, I think, that you want to put yourself out there and build a claim.
Yeah. Let's go to our first story then. We've got the Doomsday Mum. Who is the Doomsday Mum?
We have the Doomsday Mum. This one is sad. So I wanted to start with kind of three stories that you might not have heard before. I mean, there is actually quite a vast amount of people who've gone on reality TV and done the murders. You know the likes of Rodney Alcala. He was the dating game killer. He was in 1978. Then I don't know if you've ever heard of the wife swap murder.
I hadn't heard about this.
This is really interesting. Remember wife swap? It was like flawed in its very nature. But the Stockdale family appeared on ABC's wife swap in 2008. And 9 years later, the son who appeared on the show, who was crying over not being allowed to watch TV, he murdered his parents. Those are very, very prolific ones. But I found three today that probably are a little less known. The first, we'll delve in to Laurie Vallow, who is the Doomsday Mum. And in 2004, she appeared on the Wheel of Fortune.
Okay.
She's this kind of Texas beauty pageant, typical all-American blonde woman. She won $17,500, photogenic, cheerful, deeply, deeply religious character. She was actually competing in a Miss Texas beauty pageant around the same time. And when she appears on Wheel of Fortune, she talks about being a good mother, the value of being a homemaker, all that kind of stuff, loving wife. She looked very much like any kind of all-American person, the exact type of person you would expect producers to want to put on the screen.
Like all-American, girl next door, woman next door, yeah. As you said, perfect wife, perfect parent.
Exactly, perfect image. But what happened over the next 15 years is one of the strangest downfalls and strangest kind of spirals into this doomsday cult. So Laurie and her husband, Chad, actually led a small apocalyptic religious group that had broken away from mainstream Mormonism.
Okay, so they were Mormons and then found this other strand that they wanted to kind of focus on.
Deeper and deeper into the kind of the Christianity of it all. Chad, self-published author, he wrote novels about prophecies and the end of the world. He claimed that through a near-death experience as a teenager, he was having visions of the afterlife, and told Laurie, while they were both still married to other people, that they were destined to be husband and wife because they had been husband and wife in a previous life.
Okay.
And after a religious conference in 2018, the couple started dating. So they developed together this pretty intense system for rating people around them, determining whether they were light or dark and whether they were good or evil, or they've been possessed by evil spirits. Seems like a very normal thing you might bond over on your first or second
Absolutely,
date.
Absolutely, yeah. I'm purely just rating people kind of based on vibes, I'm
vibes,
presuming.
Yeah, okay, vibes. Yeah. Evil, not evil.
Okay, yeah. Cool, yeah.
But like nobody was safe. So they'd actually applied this logic to a lot of people in their own lives. And they had a friend testified that Laurie had become convinced that her 16-year-old daughter, Tylee, had become a zombie. This was the idea, that they had become so possessed and so evil that they were zombies. Laurie actually reached the same conclusion about her own 7-year-old son, JJ.
Oh my God.
So the children, those two children, were last seen alive in September 2019. 9 months later, their bodies were discovered in shallow graves on Chad's property. That wasn't it, though. So Chad was also charged with murdering his first wife, Tammy. Remember I said they were still married instead of just getting the normal divorce, which would be highly frowned upon, I guess, in the kind of religious circles. He went for the murder instead.
So he had killed her previously all those years back, and only the conviction came many years later.
After the kind of bodies of the children had been found. Laurie's brother Alex had also shot her estranged husband Charles in July 2019. So no, they weren't bothered going through with the divorces. They just thought they'd take them off the planet instead. Laurie had conspired to have him killed so she could collect his $1 million life insurance policy. Alex, her brother, died actually before he could be tried. But in 2023, Laurie was convicted of the murders of her two children and conspiracy to murder Tammy, who was Chad's ex. She was sentenced to multiple consecutive life terms without parole. Chad was convicted in 2024 and sentenced to death. In 2025, back in court in Arizona, representing herself, which is never advised.
No.
Laurie was again convicted of conspiring to murder Charles Vallow. And her defense was that having a life insurance policy was not a crime.
God, this whole story is just so tragic.
It is.
And I mean, when you said the clip is still out there of her being on Wheel of Fortune, and it's just that kind of dichotomy of what's presented on the show, this all American shit that everyone sat down and watched, and you know, what will they win? And oh my God. And then you have the what a person is capable of outside of it as a result of, I don't know, religious psychosis, a huge want for money. It's depraved.
It's kind of it's that like mix of conditions where you've got someone who maybe has a slight inclination towards murder, meet somebody else who has a slight inclination towards murder, you add in financial benefit in the mix of it all, and then that religious pressures as well. There's definitely an element of like a psychosis here, where they become so convinced, a kind of folie à deux, that they become so convinced that the people around them are possessed or turning evil or turning into zombies, so much that they can't recognise that their own children, or you know, Laurie's own children, are unfortunately the victims in all of this.
Oh my God, terrible stuff, really terrible stuff. On to the next one now. We've got John Cooper, the bullseye killer. Am I correct in saying that his TV appearance actually ended up solving the case?
Yes, so interesting. Again, and this is the kind of, shows you the audacity of these kind of people, that he was in the midst really of doing the killing when he decided it would be a good idea for him to go on TV. He didn't even really change his clothes, which is part of the undoing of all of this.
But it just goes back to what we were talking about. It has to be an ego thing, or as you said, that want for notoriety, to not at any point stop yourself and go, this could implicate me or in fact land me, you know what I mean?
Maybe I should keep a low profile.
Exactly.
Like the killing and the fame for darts really don't go hand in hand.
Yeah, sorry, bullseye, for anyone that's not familiar. I'm aware of it because it was rebooted at one point, and I was fascinated by the idea that if you hit the bullseye and you got, you know, jet skis and all that kind of crack. But it was like a darts show, like you threw darts and
You win prizes, right? And actually, John was quite a lucky fella. So in 1978, he actually won a spot the ball competition in his local paper, and he won the equivalent of like £500,000 in today's money.
Okay.
So that set him off on a path of gambling and drinking and addiction. And apparently he spiraled into quite an unlikable character, which, I mean, I think comes clear from this story. So it's grimmer in details, but there is a unique quality here in that it is his television appearance that helps solve the crime. So he's a Welsh serial killer from Pembrokeshire. And in 1985, he targeted a farmhouse in Scofflinson Park, where he shot dead a brother and a sister, Richard and Helen Thomas, before burning the house down. Then in 1989, he ambushed a couple on a coastal walking path. Their names were Peter and Gwenda Dixon, and they were from Oxfordshire. They were on holidays, had gone out for what was supposed to be their kind of final little walk before heading home. Cooper tied them up, forced them to hand over their bank cards and their pins, robbed £300 and shot them both at close range. The case went completely closed because it was the kind of village was shaken, but he was not identified. He went on to commit 30 more robberies, armed robbery, and in 1996, he attacked a group of teenagers in Milford Haven. So he was arrested in 1998 for the robberies and served 14 years. Case had gone completely cold on the murders until 2006, when a detective named Steve Wilkins reopened the case. And that led them to the television studio.
Okay, so he had gone away, committed all these other separate crimes mm-hmm. while having gotten away with the murder of these two poor unfortunates who'd been on holidays. And then he decides, I'm going to go on telly. I'm going to go on Bullseye because I'm a huge darts fan.
Yeah, it was kind of in the midst. So he'd done a murder in the farmhouse, yeah. decides to go on Bullseye, does the next murder, gets away with that, then does all the robberies, then attacks the teenagers. So he's at it. He's yeah. just like flat out at it for a couple of years.
Career criminal.
Yeah. So it's just 4 weeks before he murdered Peter and Gwenda that he went on Bullseye.
Okay.
And while he was there, he was chatting about his hobbies and mentioned that he loved scuba diving along the coastline, the very coastline where he had killed and where he would attack again. So it was just 3 weeks later that he murdered those two people. When the detective Wilkins launched the investigation, they found a microscopic drop of Peter Dixon's blood trapped on a hem of Cooper's shorts, fibers in the shotgun. Investigators froze a frame of Cooper from the program and overlaid the image with the police sketch, which is what caught him out.
Oh my God. Because you'd often hear about, or you know, you see it in popular culture or whatever, and like the jokes of, oh, the sketches don't actually look anything like the person or whatever, or you wonder like how actually useful they are. But in this instance, they were able to, as you said, overlay the freeze frame from the yeah. TV show with the police sketch and go, he was that has to be him.
Basically wearing the same clothes. Like hair looked the exact yeah. same. Even the way he stood was very similar in the police sketch. That, yeah. that was, I mean, the DNA evidence was there too.
Well, but yeah, exactly.
Was, and that if was you're, ultimately his undoing.
I'm sure they're looking him up in the system as well and going, well, he has form for this and he's been done for it before. So I
yeah,
mean.
Yeah, that's it. So he has been sentenced in 2011, given a whole life order for all of the murders. And he's likely to just die in prison.
But to daub yourself in as well, talking about your hobbies.
About your hobbies, placing yourself at the scene of the crime. Madness.
It's so interesting to be kind of position yourself as being smart enough to, oh, we'll burn the house down so there's no evidence there. But then mm-hmm. to go on telly and go, this is a place where I like going. And also, it was a place where I killed people.
Yeah.
You know?
I mean, your hobbies is like, I love going here and scuba diving. Like, he might as well have said, I love going along the coastline here and killing people.
Like, that's so, yeah, too specific. Yeah,
the audacity.
Way
the audacity.
Too, yeah, the audacity indeed. This final one then, this took a while to come to light. This is Paul Curry, the Jeopardy poisoner. What happened here?
Yes, so Paul Curry was like, by all intents and purposes, quite the genius, right? He appeared on Jeopardy in 1989, a two-time winner. He was a Mensa member. He worked as an engineer trainer at a California nuclear power plant. So literally like a rocket science, basically. He was described as the kind of man who seemed to know a little about everything, history, music, science, and someone who had won $60,000 on Jeopardy. Big, successful guy. If you have brains like that, you think you could go into any sort of career and be very, very successful. It was in 1989, though, that he met a woman called Linda Kincaid, and she was 45, 13 years his senior, a very successful, lovely, warm woman who was at the time looking for just a real relationship. And in 90, she thought she found it with Paul. So 3 years later, they were married in Las Vegas. But just a month into their marriage, Linda was telling friends that Paul was pressuring her to take out a life insurance policy for $1 million. So again, financial motive.
I was just about to say, it's the life insurance policy ends up throwing up the flags, isn't it?
Always there. Here's my top tips as someone who loves murder is never light up a room and don't take out a life insurance policy, okay? So this is going on. And what happened after was a very slow, methodical kind of campaign. Linda was hospitalized twice with mysterious stomach illness. And on one occasion, lab workers found that someone had tampered with her IV drip. So a sign actually went up in the hospital room barring Paul from entering. But Linda was none the wiser. She's like either didn't want to see it or couldn't see it in him. But by June 1994, Linda was found dead. Paul had called 911 to report she wasn't breathing. And the findings discovered nicotine poisoning, even though neither Linda or Paul smoked. There was also Ambien in her system, so she'd been sedated.
Okay.
A small injection site was found behind her right ear, And even though police suspected Paul immediately, they had not enough evidence. He'd covered his tracks with the precision of someone who was very, very smart.
Which he was.
He was. He collected over $500,000 from Linda's life insurance policies and retirement fund. He moved on to Las Vegas, then to Kansas. He remarried. Of course he did. He became a building inspector. He very much got on with his life and faced very few consequences. For 16 years.
16 years
he got away with it. Until 2002, when a detective named Yvonne Hsu picked up the cold case. And in 2007, new scientific analysis concluded that the nicotine must have been administered by a lethal injected dose and not ingested. So she managed to track Curry to Kansas, where he was living with his new comfortable life, government job, and she arrested him there and then, introducing herself as being from Orange County. She did say that the arrest felt fantastic.
How satisfying that must be, especially when you consider like that case going cold, her picking it up. It's really frustrating that obviously in 2007 you're talking about that scientific analysis where they were able to say, oh yeah, it was injected. They didn't ingest it when they'd already found the injection site. But it's just like they're missing the one or two other things to say.
Crucial pieces of evidence.
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah. Or like painting a story together.
Yeah.
Like from the outside, they look like a happy couple, which is often the way. But interestingly here, a former wife of Curry's testified that she had been frequently ill during the final year of their marriage and that he had constantly pressured her too to take out a life insurance policy. When the policy application was rejected, her health problems stopped and he left her shortly after. Yeah, so in 2014, 20 years after Linda's death, Paul Curry was convicted of first-degree murder for financial gain and sentenced to life without parole.
So they just needed the former wife put it all together.
All the little pieces coming together. So I'd say he's fucking thriving. Sorry, I'd say he's thriving in prison because he's obviously very, very smart.
Yeah, too smart. My God, we've had a text in. This reminds me of a story of two people wanted on warrant who visited their relative in jail only to be arrested by police when they were leaving the prison to make their way home. I mean, how, from your experience, obviously you're a podcaster, you've covered a lot of these stories with the Creep Drive and beyond. Like, how often is it as well? Because again, you could apply this to so many of the examples that we've just talked about there. But the criminals kind of overestimating their own intelligence or applying it incorrectly. Like, is that usually what trips people up? These are very specific examples of reality TV, but is that what gets them?
Yeah, it really does. It's kind of an arrogance around their own abilities. There is a sort of psychological, I think, superiority or an ego there where they feel like that they can outsmart prosecutors and they can outsmart the legal system. Sometimes they do for a long time. Like, they evade justice for such a long time here. You see with Stephen Curry, it was 16 years. But most of the time they are tripping themselves up, or the want for that notoriety becomes so big that they kind of continually commit the crimes until they do slip up or make a mistake.
Are there any other examples, going back to the Bullseye Killer, of the TV show kind of showing them to be who they are and kind of getting them done for their crimes?
Well, kind of interesting. If we go back to the Dating Game killer, you know, Rodney, he kind of came across as really creepy. So he actually won the dating show, and the woman that he won the date with refused to go on a date with him because she just felt,
she was so put off.
Yeah, she felt really bad vibes. And it turned out he was a serial killer who was actively on a killing spree at the time that he appeared on the show again. So I think in that instance, the footage of him on the show is used as a sort of evidence to his character, you know, so they're kind of viewing how he interacts with women, the stuff that he says, and it's building a psychological profile of him.
I know we were laughing about vibes earlier, but sometimes maybe do go on vibes.
Trust the gut,
the intuition. Cassie Delaney, podcaster, thank you so much. That was the Moncrief Murder Club.
Moncrief, weekdays at 2 on News Talk. Conversation that counts.